Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and... Sorry. I might start that again.
What's wrong?
Even your water bottle?
It's going to come out a few times today.
Let's try that again, shall we? Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome, everybody, finally, to Season 4, Episode 26 of Cinematica. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio to celebrate the final episode of Season number 4 and...
Our second birthday!
Our second birthday, yes. It was the 11th of October, 2011, when we recorded our very first episode
2011.
Of... 2011.
I know. Isn't that amazing? Little babies.
Well, technically, well, I guess we're toddlers now.
Yeah, we're going to have the 10 years soon, aren't we?
Watch out, everybody.
What do you mean? No, you don't understand. That's how we can review now. You don't understand.
Exactly. You can't make me.
Yep.
Yeah. Whereas our reviews now are just no.
No.
And at least one of us around this table has already had some cake today, which means that I'm sort of feeling a little bit sleepy from all the sugar. I really shouldn't have one of those impressive Lighthouse Cinema lunches before we go to air, but it's just so tempting. That cabinet is full of delights.
Just like the rest of us here.
And I even got a table on what is the most crazy day. It's Seniors Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's the school holidays.
It's
so
raining.
The seniors have got their grandchildren in tow, mm-hmm. And it's raining.
Yep.
It's like a perfect storm.
We're going to review it later, but you know, it's interesting how many seniors and parents are taking their kids to Gravity, actually.
Right. Mm. Well, we should interview some seniors about their Gravity experience and see whether, you know, because it's about as modern, isn't it? It's about as modern and as up to date as any film you can get. You
know? Yeah.
But we shall talk about that later on. Because Bullock and Clooney, Lost in Space and Gravity, that's our first film of the day. Also, we'll be talking about Hugh Laurie teaching the kids of Bougainville about Charles Dickens and Andrew Adamson's Mr. Pip. Just the two and a bit films to discuss in today's show. So hopefully that means that we'll get the whole thing completed, you know, before you finish your run or your commute to work.
We aim to please.
Well, we do our best, don't we? Mm. No one can say that we don't try.
Mm.
Kaylee, have you been monitoring the mailbag for us?
Yeah, we have a lot this week. Let's start with Huey Frenzy, who said, my kids all said Smurfs 2 was better than the first movie. My two-word review is kids-friendly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Pretty fair.
Yeah, Miriam Ross's two-word review for Gravity, Stereo Space. Hmm. We have a two-word review of our last episode from Reese Pie. More Graham. Doesn't mean I don't want Simon back, but Graham had me in stitches, so two thumbs
Very
up.
Good.
Yep, and Graham has offered his services to us whenever we need him.
Oh. Good.
So, okay. It's possible. And because, you know, one of our popular guest, Steve Gray, he now lives in Taupo, unfortunately, which means that getting him on the show is going to prove difficult. So, we do need some guest reviewers. And, of course, you're going away on holiday, so you're away for a week. We're going to need someone to fill in for you next week.
Mm.
Who can it be? Maybe we should do a little poll.
Yeah, just tweet us if you want to be on the show, really. That's all you have to do.
Yeah, you just got to have Skype and you've got to be available at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. That's basically the only...
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you need to just take a minute at work and, you know... ask people to leave the room or something, or just find a little closet and set it up. That's fine.
Yeah,
I encourage it.
Mm. Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did a whole interview for this show at Christmas last year in the boardroom of Showbiz Christchurch. While I was there for a meeting about something else, I said, "Excuse me, do you mind if I use your boardroom for 10 minutes?" And they went, "Yeah, sure." It's great.
There you go.
So you can. A broom closet is perfectly acceptable.
Hudsy42 says, Dan Slevin and Cinematica, idea for you, get the Lighthouse to give you a weekly double bill slot to curate and use Cinematica to promote it. I'd go.
I know. And we had, that was not the only vote. for that idea. So perhaps we should talk about that off air. Seeing as the person who actually makes the decisions is here, we should probably not just drop him in it.
Yes. Barnaby HM sent his two-word review for Gravity. And these don't even have the hashtag two-word review. We're just, it's just like they're just sending us words and the titles of films. It's brilliant. It's getting even more compressed. Gravity, for real? Question mark. And also from the lovely Rudy, got a little email.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Just a quick hi. And also wanted to say the last episode was awesome. Just wanted to share a quick fact about Cars and Disney. You know the story behind it, right? Cars was the last movie that Pixar did before they left Disney in 2005. So Disney decided to keep it and release Chicken Little, which was their own animation and a total fail. So then they released Cars around Xmas, around Christmas. I'm just reading what I see. anyhow, Cars wasn't a success, as successful as they thought. But by then, Disney had the exclusive rights as Pixar was independent. The success of Cars and Cars 2, even though it was a complete fail,
artistically,
has been the worst movie from Pixar Disney. The success for Cars for Disney has been collectibles like toys, napkins, blankets, one of which he has, lunchboxes, toothbrushes.
I bet you he's got a Cars duvet
cover.
All
that stuff. Maybe.
Yeah. Be like one of those racing car beds that toddlers have.
He's pretty tall. I don't think he'd fit in it.
No.
Maybe it's just more of a throw.
Yeah, that's what I'm... You know.
Like, anyway, so that was just a little fact from Rudy.
Good old Rudy.
Keep bringing us facts.
Yeah, and he is...
Why not?
He is
keep
also...
sending emails. I like the emails.
Yeah, emails.
The two-word review, for people who find the two-word review thing a bit restrictive, you know, don't feel like you have to just, you know, fit into that. If you've got more, give it to us. And I know Rudy is also very, very keen for this whole live tweeting Mean Girls.
I'm excited.
Thing. So sometime in November we'll be doing that.
Maybe we should like rent out a cinema.
Oh, yeah. Into a Mean Girls screening.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
who's the distributor for that?
Disney, I think.
Mean Girls,
wasn't it?
Might be. Anyway, I'll find out.
Yeah. Well, okay. Simon's on it.
Excellent.
So,
information for tickets will be coming soon.
What have people been watching this weekend? I can guess. Actually,
there's a lot of movement. A lot of movement this week. In number 5, down from 2, is Planes. In at number 4 is Grown Ups 2, which Dan will be doing a very quick review of.
Now, actually. So talking of movement, my two-word review for Grown Ups 2 is Bowel Movement. It's the worst film of the year. In fact, I saw the best film of the year and the worst film of the year this week. You know, and we'll talk about the best later on. But Grown Ups 2, the laziest, most insulting, not funny. Like I saw it on Thursday night, which is the opening day, right? So the people who were there, Adam Sandler fans, he's always had a really strong following here in New Zealand. Grown Ups, the first one, did good box office, hence Grown Ups 2. And everybody in the theatre was as completely disengaged and disinterested as everybody on the screen was. I've never been surrounded by people Facebooking. I mean, not just checking the phone, not just checking the time or anything like that, genuinely like scrolling through their Facebook feeds.
Yeah, finishing off a bit of work.
And you know what? I couldn't blame them because, you know, if Sandler and his mates are going to try and charge money to watch them basically muck around on holiday, which is what happens, then, you know, they deserve the lack of attention that they get from people. You know, this was a real disappointment. And, it's still going to do business because it's got Sandler's name on it. And I know my flatmates went because Monica, she said, oh, I'm a huge Adam Sandler fan, and Rodrigo, her partner, he just was shaking his head behind her. as I was saying, oh, how did it go? He was going, horrible, horrible film. And Monica was, I loved it. So, you know, what can you do? But, yeah, please, no more. Somebody should just give Adam Sandler enough money that he can retire. I mean, he's probably got enough money that he can retire, but, like, whatever it is that he needs to shut up.
Mm.
That's it. What's next? I'm not going to be, yeah. You know, neither of you wasted your Thursday evening going.
No.
Right.
No.
So, you know, so there's not much more to say, is there?
No.
Why?
I don't know. I could go into this, but I won't. In at number 3, up from 5, The Smurfs 2. Someone was listening. Number 2.
That was probably just Graham. That one extra ticket that we sold.
In 2, down from 1, is Turbo, and in the number 1 position this week is Gravity.
Right.
And good choice, people.
Yeah, very good choice.
And just looking at the US results for Gravity, which I think people knew it was going to be strong, but I don't think anyone realized it was going to be quite this strong. So 50 million plus opening weekend for Gravity domestically in the US, which is Sandra Bullock's second 50 million opening week of the year, because of course there was The Heat a little bit earlier on. So Sandra Bullock, box office gold still. Just you can't beat that. And for George Clooney, it's the biggest opening weekend for a George Clooney film since Batman and Robin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
What about all the Oceans films?
All of them. Opening weekend, tonking all of them. So,
interesting.
Yes. So, from that point of view, you know, a fantastic success already. And I think, you know, the response from critics, a critical success. And we're going to discuss it now, actually, and find out whether we think, because, of course, our opinion is the clincher.
Well, it's the most important thing on this podcast.
Yeah, certainly. We're going to tell you whether it's an artistic success.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort.
Explorer, this is Kowalski confirming visual contact with debris. Debris is from a BSE sat. Repeat.
I have a
Dr. Stone requesting faster transport.
We have to go. We have to go, go, go.
Kennedy reports meteorological conditions. No go.
Houston, Explorer, copy.
Explorer, Dr. Stone requesting faster transport to Bay Area. Explorer, do you copy?
Explorer, permission to retrieve Dr. Stone.
Your go, Kowalski. Houston, Explorer, copy.
All right.
We've lost Houston.
Simon, you're our NASA expert. You're our outer space correspondent. Do you want to start off with giving people a bit of the plot?
Well, it's quite a simple premise, really, isn't it? I mean,
without spoilers.
Without oh yeah, I don't think that's impossible, really.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's visually just incredibly stunning opening and setting where you've got Sandra Bullock playing a doctor who's working on this project in space. You don't even really know what she's working on, but she's just working
on
something.
They mention the Hubble, don't they? The Hubble telescope, and so it's obviously something to do with that, but it's not going well,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. She's frustrated and she's annoyed, and Clooney's floating around, kind of, he's the commander-in-charge sort of astronaut, and he's just puffing around,
wisecracking away,
playing music, just sort of keeping everyone happy. And then, of course, it all turns to custard, and the Russians have destroyed a satellite which has created all this debris and is going to arrive soon, and that's how it kicks off. You know, it doesn't take long to get going.
And
then it just rolls on from there about how they initially get this massive impact from all this debris that comes flying through, and they survive. Well, do they? I can't say too much.
Well,
but,
I don't
but
know.
Things
I think,
happen.
I
you
think
know?
We can probably say that they can't get back to the shuttle.
They can't.
So
get
they've
back
got to
the
find. They've got to find another way. They've lost all contact with Houston.
Yep.
Which means that there's nobody knows whether they're still alive. They don't know whether Houston can hear them. They've got to try and find their way back to the International Space Station, which is like 200 kilometres away
it
or
is,
something.
But
you know.
Can kind of see it.
In the distance, yeah, beckoning them.
And it is incredible to look at, the whole film. The whole way through is just incredible to look at. And the great thing about it is that this debris, it's coming, you know, it's got the old set your watch thing, because it's coming back, of course. It's going to come round again.
Yeah.
And so they're racing the clock on, and, you know.
There are clocks. Sometimes there are 3 countdowns going at once. You know, it's so tense. There's the, you know, that ticking clock thing that keeps you on edge when you're at the movies. There's a lot in gravity, and it just there is, yeah. and they because I guess the nature of space is, you know, there's countdowns all the time, you know, counting down to liftoff, counting down to separation, counting down to all of that stuff, and it is just so tense.
And every time you get from A to B, you've got to go through a procedure. You've got to sort of unlock the keys and do this and that. You know, you've got to you've got to follow the process. And then often it's
and in different... And read the manual at the same time.
And it's in different languages. Yes. And the clock is ticking. It's really, really good. I mean, it's really, really tense. It is. Mm. You're on the edge of the seat the whole way through.
Yeah.
And I have to say that it is the most beautiful, stunning film to look at. It is just incredible. There are a few moments in the film where I went, oh, really? But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. It just keeps going along at that pace and keeping that tension up. I was really impressed.
I think that there's a lot of debate online about minutiae in this film. You know, how realistic is it? You know, Buzz Aldrin, the famous NASA astronaut, says that it's, you know, the most realistic presentation of space ever. And then there are a physicist called Neil Tyson who has spent the last few days tweeting all of the things that are wrong with it. And, you know, but I think that it's a sign of a film that that's as good as this, that that when we're talking about criticism and criticizing it, we're picking it apart for things that we wouldn't get upset about or arrested about, you know, with other films. You know, this is a film that, you know, we want it to be, it's 99% perfect, and we want it to be 100%, and we're gonna try and isolate the things that the tiny little things that don't work. But the sweep of it is fantastic.
And the way that it's filmed, I mean, yeah. I just can't believe how it's been filmed, and the way that it creates the sense of being a complete speck, that these people are just nothing in the cosmos, and actually Earth is absolutely nothing when you look at it from that point of view. But the way that that's sort of captured in the film,
how high up are they? Didn't they say something like they're 35 miles up or something, which is what, here to Otaki?
Not that far.
Nah. What are they worried about? Anyway, Kaylee.
Well, you sort of have to worry about getting sucked into the atmosphere and plummeting towards Earth in your spacesuit.
Yeah.
If you're not in a little, you know, capsule. That's worrying.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I suppose.
Yeah. Or floating out the other way.
And of course, because there is no gravity, you know, once you start in one particular direction,
can't really stop.
You keep going. Yes. I've thrown to you twice. Keep.
Take control. Just taking it away from me. Spiraling in space. Oh, God.
Okay. I'm shutting up now.
This has got to be one of the best films I've seen in a very long time. I don't know how often I actually breathed while watching the film. I was holding my breath most of the time. And the great thing is because you're in space, there's a lot of blackness. You are watching this in a dark theater and the only light is coming from the screen. And so you very much feel involved. A lot of close-ups and the camera's spinning and it's like very disorienting at some times. And the 3D was amazing. Mm. Like, and I've been hearing a lot, and I'll say it again, like, this is what 3D was made for. And, you know, when they have that space junk flying at them, there is stuff not flying to the side of you, like into your face. It's I was like flailing.
Yeah. It is the best 3D film I've seen. I think it's better than Avatar and Pi, and I thought Pi was, you know, I thought they were both amazing. I think this is better.
Pi was the first time that we really felt like an artist had got hold of the technology to use the technology to amplify the themes, you know, some metaphorical weight, you know, the distance.
And the work here is that of an artist as well.
I think so, yeah. Absolutely, because, you know, if you want something on the screen if you want to feel how isolated these people are, away from each other often, or from safety, or from home, then the 3D just gives you that, it just paints that picture absolutely perfectly. And on the flip side, again, as you were saying, the stuff that's, you know, the threats that come towards them are very, very real. It's incredibly fluid as well. You know, Cuarón, as we know from Children of Men, is the modern master of the long take, you know, the 8-minute, 9-minute fluid. Yeah, the fluid camera, you know, if he doesn't cut unless he absolutely has to. He can move the camera around, and it always seems to be going where you, as an audience member, want it to go next, to reveal something. But this isn't that sort of modern shaky cam, you know, just shoot a whole lot of stuff and hope for the best. Because it's almost entirely CGI, it's incredibly well planned out. I've been getting hints and notes about how the film got made, you know, like links to stories, and I don't want to know, you know, like I want to preserve the magic of it if I can, you know. But I did read a story about how so much of the film was shot with the camera on those factory robots that they get used in car factories, you know, where they can just do a precision move and recreate it over and over again. And you know, the technology and the skill and the imagination that's gone into simply making the film and realizing the vision is extraordinary. I've sat there fairly dumbfounded on Saturday evening, and I thought I'd watched, this is like the first film of the 21st century, you know. It's like there's a, you know, sometimes you see something and you go, everything, there's a before and after moment.
Imagine, and now, this is a double feature of 2001.
Yeah. Well,
but, you know, mind blown.
But you're absolutely right. It's taking it to a new level, and it's interesting that this is a film that you can't watch on your computer, you can't watch it on your iPad, you can't watch it on your TV. It is designed for film, for theatres, and it is absolutely spectacular. To watch it any other way just completely diminishes it, would just make it a totally different film.
I completely agree. And without ever losing sight of the human story at the centre of it, you know?
Yeah, but that's the weakness, I thought. I thought the story was a bit kind of, yeah, okay, really? You know, I mean, for somebody who's in that position, who has probably worked very hard to get there, I thought, well, I mean, I thought, you know, Bullock's character sort of was a bit weak. But, you know, Clooney, he could get away with it, but I thought her character was a bit weak. Even though she was fine. And the whole, the moment, the sort of 2001 Lycra moment, I couldn't, you know, like where she's floating in a Lycra. I mean, I think they're wearing big nappies and stuff like that.
Well,
in outer space.
that may or may not be true. And you know, it's not a documentary, right? It's not meant to.
No, it's not. But that, you know how you have. I just had for two moments in that film. I went, my sense of belief was suspended. You know, I was like, you know, it had me completely immersed in this world, except for two times in the film when it pulled me right back down again, and I thought, oh, okay, you know. But it didn't take long to get cracking again, but two moments in the film I thought well, that they were a bit weak.
Okay, well, I had one moment like that early on, and it rescued. It came back to that same story, or it came back to that theme, and it kind of rescued it for me, rescued the choice. I was really moved by the story, the sense that somebody who, you know, there's people have talked about, oh, there's not enough character development, or there's not enough narrative development. It's like, it's really precise, you know. It's a very simple peril. Do you fight for your life, or do you not, you know? And that's the choice that Bullock's character in particular has to make, you know. Is like, is she going to fight, or is she just going to let fate take its course? And it seems to me that doesn't have to be particularly sophisticated storytelling leading up to or after that, because the decision itself is so profound.
Yeah, look, I agree. I wouldn't disagree with you at all on that, but I just think that the scene where she basically gets to where she's got to get, and then for whatever reason she takes everything off and then floats in space when the clock's ticking, remember? The debris is coming. You're meant to be, you know, like...
But she also doesn't know. She also doesn't know that it's on fire.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing, though. Like in those situations, you wouldn't hesitate to. You wouldn't just kind of have a snooze. And I don't know. Like, I found that a little bit kind of, you know, surprising, I guess, because I would have thought you'd just kick into gear and keep going, because this is a roller coaster race. This is a roller coaster, and you don't stop. You know, you keep moving.
Right. So that's a motivational sort of a character thing. You don't believe the character would have done.
I don't think the character would do that, because they're trained. They would have been trained to do otherwise.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, but don't forget, they make it clear at the beginning of the film that she's only.
But even your survival instincts would get you moving. You wouldn't just kind of. become jelly and float around for 20 minutes or 30 minutes.
She heads for where she's supposed to get to, which is at the other end of the space station. Presumably she's also been trained that when she's on the space station, she doesn't need the space suit. Like, I'm not making excuses for it. Well, I am actually a little bit.
Yeah, I think you are.
Yeah.
See, that's what I would do. She's like incredibly traumatized after just getting in, and she's sitting there letting oxygen get back into her body.
She thinks she's safe.
Yeah, no, there's that too.
She doesn't because remember, it's coming around again, and she knows that. That's why she's raced there. That's why she's set her watch. That's why she's on the fly, because she knows.
Yeah, but she needs a minute to let her body adjust. She's just been breathing CO2 for like three minutes.
It's not kind of a rest or a short sort of a few puffs, you know. It's kind of like, and in fact it conveys quite a long period of time potentially. Like, you look at that scene and you're not sure how long it actually is, so I thought that was a bit kind of odd.
I think that there are probably,
because I think your survival instincts would kick in, even though you're right that you've had this, you know, she's not 100% and all the rest of it. I think your survival instincts would keep you going. The adrenaline would just keep you going,
right? Well, while
I'm taking out,
I think there are definitely nits to pick. But the sign is that we're basically arguing over this one.
We are.
Is a sign.
Right.
Is
right.
You know,
the flaws are not great, and they're not. You can move along really quickly and not be bothered by them at all.
And the film does move along really quickly. Mm.
It's 98 minutes long, so that's a really, really good length for
like
a modern film.
Minutes.
I know. Exactly. So it's a really. It doesn't add any more than it absolutely needs to tell its story. Which is, you know, cinema owners love it because you can get an extra session in, you know, when you're only 98 minutes.
Yep.
And I think that this is a film that is going to do a lot of second,
I agree,
viewing business.
Yeah. I will see it again. I want to see it twice. I could probably sit through it three times, actually. I was in awe of it when I came out.
Well, because there's so much detail, isn't there? There's so much going on behind away from the focus, you know, that I'd like to watch it just to really appreciate the production design, just to really appreciate the craft that went into it. So maybe that's my third go will be to just watch for the details, watch for the things that maybe I missed out the first time around.
And interestingly, you know, we're seeing families, we're seeing seniors with grandchildren, I guess the holidays at the moment, but it's interesting that it has got a wide brush, you know, and that the word is strong, that it'll just continue. So, you know, it's great to see possibly people who wouldn't naturally go to a film like that in 3D are actually, you know, checking it out.
Yep.
So it's great.
And also, a movie about space with a female astronaut. Hello, finally.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. And Bullock, who would not necessarily have been anybody's first choice, you know, as a romantic comedy specialist. She's won an Academy Award for Blindside, of course, which was only a couple of years ago. And, you know, just looking up at the skylight, and perhaps eagerly listeners will be worried whether we're going to drown. But so what are the odds on Sandra Bullock getting two Oscars, you know, the second
Oscar? I think pretty good.
Yeah.
Really?
Good.
Not for this.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry.
Well, who else? Meryl Streep for August Sausage
plenty,
County, or whatever it's called.
There's plenty to come through before that happens. Right, okay. Plenty.
All right. Well, something else, or a couple of final thoughts from me. I know a lot of our Auckland listeners and Auckland correspondents have seen it at the big IMAX screen and have said, if you have an IMAX screen that you can go to, then you absolutely must see it in that environment. I think we should make sure that note is passed on to everybody. But also, I saw it at the Embassy Theatre in Wellington, which has the Dolby Atmos sound. And I said this to you a little bit earlier, Simon, I felt like the Atmos sound was more effective in creating the world and the appreciating the space of space than the 3D. Somebody has actually made Atmos work, and boom. The only technology that it doesn't make use of is 48 frames, and I wonder whether, you know, high frame rate might have made a difference to it or not. I certainly didn't feel like I was missing any frames, did I?
I mean, isn't that interesting? I mean, you wouldn't. I mean, I couldn't think In some ways, you might damage this beautiful thing. You wouldn't want to touch it with 48 frames because it's just so stunning.
Yeah, it's
an interesting point.
And that whole high frame rate question is going to come up again in just a couple of months, isn't it? When the next Hobbit comes out, and we'll wonder whether the people behind that will have learned a few things from the last time round. We should go around the table and sum up. You know, I think people will get a fair idea that we're recommending this one pretty highly. But Kaylee, do you want to? You said you had your two.
Yes, I remember that my two-word review for Gravity is breathtaking. Now, I know probably most of our listeners will enjoy Gravity, but I have heard from people who don't enjoy it, so it might not be for everyone.
Really?
But who are they? Who?
Yeah, we want their names.
Yeah, I came out yesterday, and there was a young woman who's like, "Oh, it's okay," but that wasn't really a storyline. It was took me all my strength not to like smack my hand against my forehead being like, "You are so dumb."
Yeah like what I think that there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the word story means when people say, "Oh, there wasn't a storyline." What did you want that to start off back down on Earth or something and then have
there wasn't a dog in it.
There was.
What?
Was it a dog or a baby? No, she was a baby. No, there was a dog, the Russian guy, and on the radio. There was a yappy dog. There was a baby. That was my number two moment.
Oh, was it where you just lost it for a moment?
Really? Did you have to?
I was sweet sugar
little moment.
I was totally in there. But you know, the whole point of the exercise really is making the emotional connections inside this completely inhuman environment.
No, it's about the obstacles, and it's about the race and the obstacles in your way. It's about unlocking the next key. That's all it's about. That's what's stunning about it.
This is a profound metaphor about the human condition.
But it's that whole tension. It's fantastic. Yeah, and if you're breaking it down to
subtext,
but if you're breaking it down to like, you know, the scene with a dog and a baby and she's crying, and I mean, I was thinking, yeah.
But is that bit real? Is she just imagining it?
Oh,
that was real.
Is it?
Yeah.
Mm.
Those zero gravity tears.
They were real.
They were real.
Yeah. Yep.
Pretty flash. All right.
But I don't know.
I think you're not seeing maybe the second time you see it, Simon. Maybe the second time.
Yeah.
I'm gonna set you a quest. I'm gonna ask you to go looking for subtext and the emotional layers.
Well, to me, the emotional layers aren't that strong, and that's just the weakness of the film for me. I think that everything else though is fantastic.
Okay.
Anyway, so I my two words: spacewalk mayhem.
Boom. Okay, my two words: high flyer for Gravity, Alfonso Cuarón. And follow that.
I will, with some great news. The New Zealand International Film Festival has successfully reached their boosted crowdfunding target to raise money for a digital projector at Christchurch's Isaac Theatre Royal. This keeps the plan on track to have full DCP ability at a fabulous venue for next year's festival and gives the Christchurch event a home to rival Auckland's Civic, Wellington's Embassy, and Dunedin's Regent. The festival has also announced dates for next year in Auckland, Wellington, and Dunedin. Scratch out the 2.5 weeks from the 17th of July 2014 in Auckland, the 25th of July in Wellington, and the 31st of July in Dunedin. That's about the same as this year.
Yeah, I think it, you know, worked pretty well. They sent out a newsletter today to certainly to all of their Wellington subscribers with the responses to, or a summary of the responses to their survey, which was very very, very interesting and worthwhile. So, you know, if you're not a subscriber, I think you can find that that article on their website. It's worth a look because you know, whenever I've talked to Bill about the festival, he does tend to sigh at the conflicting requirements and requests and desires of the film festival audience, and pretty much the inability to please everybody. You know,
it's impossible.
It is, exactly, and so you'll get a sense of that running through this.
But I think the people, I think as someone who's experienced programming at the film festival office, I think if the people who are complaining come in and do it and see how difficult it is and how difficult it is to actually get content, maybe they'd simmer down a bit.
Yeah, and exactly. And it was interesting also that they, in the newsletter, they've mentioned the fact that they're supporting the release of The Turning, which is coming out, and how it would have been in the festival if it wasn't for, well, there's a lovely phrase, the vagaries of international premiere requirements or something. You know, and it's like, yeah, they you know, it would have fit perfectly into the New Zealand International Film Festival, but the fact that it had to launch in Melbourne,
yeah,
you know, meant that it wasn't available. But I think it's really good that, you know, it's like a little bonus, isn't it, when The Turning comes out, that, you know, it's festival quality product, and they're putting some of their weight behind it, which is great.
In sad news, French director Patrice Chéreau has passed away at the age of only 68, best known in cinema for Queen Margot, which won the Grand Prix at Cannes in 1994, and Intimacy, starring Carrie Fox, in 2001. He was also a renowned theater and opera director, including rejuvenating the home of Wagner at Bayreuth with a groundbreaking ring cycle in 1976.
Or Bayreuth.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah. For future reference. Next time you get to do a story about Wagner.
Next time I go there, I won't sound like a jerk. Blue Jasmine will not be adding to its international box office take in India, as the government's strict anti-smoking, on screen at least, rules have forced director Woody Allen to draw the film from exhibition. The law in India mandates that a film in which characters smoke must have an anti-smoking advertisement play before the screening, which might not be too much of a problem, but also anti-smoking captions and subtitles playing over the film whenever a character is seen smoking. There are two scenes of smoking in Blue Jasmine.
Yeah, so that's basically, you know, interfering with an artist's vision, isn't it? You know, so I can understand why Mr. Allen might demur at that. But
there it's funny though, isn't it? Because there is a lot of smoking in movies. A lot.
Not as much as there used to be. You know, when it was basically paid advertising,
still a sexy thing to do at the movies.
Yeah, it is. Watching High Fidelity, which I did the other week, I was like, oh my God, there's so much smoking in this film.
Yeah, that's actually only, 10 years old.
Yeah, way more than other films.
There was a screening of Ghostbusters at the embassy a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And Ghostbusters, which is what, 1984 or something like that.
Was a chocker full of smoking.
It was. Everybody. Everybody's walking down the street smoking. They're lighting up, and it's all paid product placement, you know. It was outrageous in those days. And you know, I'm not quite sure what the potential box office for Blue Jasmine in India was, but certainly somebody's
but I'm sure there's some alcohol in Blue Jasmine as well. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but I don't think that's such a problem in India, where you know, the both the main religions are not.
That's very true, actually. Yeah,
it's more Middle East stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, definitely smoking a big public health problem. Where isn't it? Not so much here now, I suspect. Yeah, because
I think you're looking at a few billion.
Oh, I think.
Yeah, healthcare wise.
But not as bad as it used to be.
Probably not.
No, thanks to Auntie Helen and Nanny State. You're not allowed to smoke anywhere. My friend Johnny, who's been on the show here once, in the days when he was a chain smoker, he said, one day I'm going to buy a house and all the non-smokers have to sit outside on the veranda. But anyway, he's now a reformed smoker. So, you know, as so many people are. So there you go. I mean, saved I don't know how many thousands of health dollars on him. You know, that's a win, isn't it?
Got to take him.
Yeah, indeed. All right, so that was our news.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well read. We've got one more film to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do it.
This young fellow has great expectations. Pip has to be brought up as a gentleman.
Can anyone be a gentleman?
Yes, they can.
Even a poor person?
Absolutely.
We saw a signal on the beach. What is PIP?
Pip is a confusion I failed to see coming. He's a character out of a book.
Let it go!
I will not be lied to.
Andrew Adamson's film of Lloyd Jones's novel Mr. Pip, with Hugh Laurie as what's the teacher? Well, he's not really a teacher, is he? He just happens to be the only white man left after the blockade of Bougainville in the early 1990s during the Civil War there, and the village children need a teacher, so he volunteers and he teaches the only thing he knows, really, which is Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. And all he really does is he reads it to them a chapter a day, and uses it as the basis for, you know, questions and answers about life and the world outside the village. And, well, that's probably the first act of a film that goes in some surprising directions, doesn't it, Simon?
It does, yeah. I mean, you're talking about the classes, and one point of where it takes you and one point of conflict is you know, the education versus church and what's happening and what's being taught in the class. And that certainly is something that, that you know, it's an interesting path that it takes, and how it's kind of, I don't know if it's ultimately resolved, but it's kind of... they coexist and work out a path. And I thought that was, yeah, I mean, so that's one little path that it takes you on. And then, of course, the violence and the war that's going on and the ignorance that is, you know, wrapped up in all of that.
And the appalling impact that that has on innocent people just trying to get on with their lives, you know. And it's made clear at the beginning of the film that the source for all of this pain and damage that's being inflicted is the multinational.
It's a Western. It's a Western source, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. The mining. The basically, you know, raping the natural environment of Bougainville for a reward that isn't going to come flooding back to the people who live there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and there's a really wasn't overstated, it didn't bang you on the head, but, you know, about three quarters of the way through the film, there's a scene where the young woman is back in the West, you know, she's in the Western world, in Perth somewhere or like that, you know, outside of Perth in the mining area, where she's going through the school and she's going through, and she's seeing all these things where copper has this influence over their world. And you can just see it ticking over. You can just see her sort of walking through and connecting the dots. And I thought it wasn't heavy-handed in any way, but it was really, I mean, for me anyway, it was a really powerful sort of part of the film because it was, you know, it was sort of highlighting that cost. You know, here was that cost, and here's the cost that it actually takes for us to get the things that we want. And it was I thought a really powerful part of the film.
In last week's show, we played an extract from an interview that I was lucky enough to do with Lloyd Jones, who wrote the original novel, Mr. Pip. And the whole of that interview is available as an extra Cinematica extra download, and it's worth listening to. Probably worth listening to after you've seen the film. You probably get more benefit out of it than beforehand, perhaps. But it was very interesting talking to him about the reason why Great Expectations and Dickens in particular was how he sort of was able to weave, or why he chose to weave that particular story and that particular literary set of metaphors, I guess, through the world that he'd created, the very dark modern world of Bougainville in the 90s. And, you know, this idea that, you know, anyone, as we just heard, you know, anyone can become a gentleman, no matter how unlikely your start out in life, and you can also reinvent yourself. You can, you know, the past doesn't have to equal the future for you, which for those kids who for a while they don't look like they've got any future at all, you know, particularly Matilda, the bright young girl who's the sort of center of the film, you know, that I think it's really interesting the choice of Great Expectations, a story that we've seen told on film just this year, in fact, and, you know, to have that sort of that idea woven through it. How did you feel about that, Simon?
You know, I thought it was I thought that was all very well handled, and I thought it was interesting, and the sense of escapism for her and this world that existed, which gave her confidence, which gave her strength to come out in herself and to question her mother, you know, and question her sort of philosophies on things, I thought was powerful.
Yeah, and ultimately it gives her the strength to survive. We were talking about Sandra Bullock in Gravity and what it takes to make somebody choose, you know, to perhaps overcome what they consider to be their limitations or their inabilities, you know.
But ultimately, you know, I mean, all there were big sections that I've sacrificed, weren't there?
Yep.
Like people sacrificing themselves
for others,
yep. and it's a very traumatic period of the film where those things happen. I found, you know, very hard, you know, quite hard to watch, and certainly Yeah, you wouldn't, you know, like, quite tragic. And I thought Matilda's character in a way was just being swept along by that, still not quite sure what decisions to make. Mm. And in fact, in a way, she's always being swept along in the film, if you ask me. Like, she certainly gravitates towards Dickens and all those things, but she's still being swept along without actually making any firm choices. The choices, in a way, are kind of hoisted upon her.
Right.
I mean, would you agree? Or
I feel like there's a moment where she gets the opportunity to escape, and that requires considerable bravery on her part to go through with that, and you know, almost drowns, you know, in that process. I wanted to ask you about Hugh Laurie now, and what you thought of him, because you know, we know him as a comedian, or as that television doctor, who has his own sort of. I mean, he's an amusing character, a witty character, that the house, and so you know, I thought this was a side of him that I had never seen before.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought he was very well cast for this role. And he bought a you know, he was vulnerable. His character was vulnerable, had its flaws, and you know, I thought did a magnificent job of carrying off the role. I mean, yeah, it's a funny film because you know, it's one of those films where you've got this professional actor and then you've got all these amateurs and so on.
But so much of it relies on him.
It does. It really hangs on him. So, you know, so much of it does. But then they all contribute to me. They all stand up and get, you know, and do a really good job with their performances. But he is, you know, he's got to carry a lot of it, and he does it very, very well.
Mm. There are two audiences for this film in New Zealand, I think. There's the people who've read Lloyd Jones's book, who will have a very who will be prepared for some of the twists and turns that it takes, and then there are people like me who haven't read the book, who get blindsided.
Yeah.
And it took when I watched it, because all I really knew was the trailer, and the trailer presents pretty much only the first half of the film, and when it really sort of takes off. Yeah, you have to get carried. You're just carried along by it, and there was a point just after halfway where I thought, well, I don't know what's going to happen now, and I don't watch many films like that.
Mm.
You know, where
you always had a sense of foreboding, though, didn't you? Like
there was
good things were not going to happen.
Yeah.
But what was going to happen to each individual and how it was going to end up for them was completely up to
and
question.
The extent. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, to me, it was a political film, you know, with a message, and it's not a bang you over the head sort of message, but it's quite a, you know, a very well crafted sort of observation. And if you look at that and you sort of look at other things and connect the dots, it's not a very nice it's not a very nice sort of realization, I guess, and the film does that very well, I think.
I've got one more question that I'd like to throw out to you, and that is that Andrew Adamson, best known for Narnia and Shrek, and the last time we saw his name on the credits for a film was the Cirque du Soleil film last year, I think. And who would have thought that he had this in him? You know, that this is I think it's often really moving, profound, very very sensitively put together.
But he did have connections to that part of the world, doesn't he?
He grew up in PNG.
Yeah.
But
which
just
I think
knowing
helps a lot,
it does help, but just knowing the location doesn't necessarily still mean that you can tell a story like this, you know, in such a controlled and sensitive way, you know. I just think that I just want to see him make more films.
Oh,
you
completely.
Know?
I think more films like this too. Like, you know, he's lifted the bar in my eyes because he's created these kind of mainstream blockbuster type films, pretty much. You know, that's what he's famous for. But this is a serious drama, which is quite a difference to that, and must be really refreshing, I guess, maybe. And I think, you know, like that. Yeah, he did a fantastic job with this film, and hopefully there's more to come like that.
Yeah, and I noticed I heard an interview with him on a show somewhere else. And he actually said that he has got no other plans at the moment. He's sort of there's nothing concrete in his future. He's just living in Auckland and waiting for the next thing to turn up, which I think is a little bit sad. I would like to think that he's got their ideas and projects are flooding towards him.
Yeah, but he would be someone that could be a contractor director if he chose to be.
Oh, exactly. He could go to Hollywood now, and he could just be a hired gun. But I suspect that after doing something like this, that wouldn't be satisfying.
Very true. Very true.
So, are we going to try and sum this up in two words?
Oh, You go.
Well, mine would be Pacific heartbreak.
Sad and inspiring.
Sad and inspiring. Oh yeah, you got the "and" in there. Brilliant. I should have done
three,
that. I should.
Three.
Well, no, because I, you know,
yeah, you can do the ampersand. Is it?
Yeah, you can do the ampersand. Yeah, exactly. And you know, look, I think that we just rewrite the rules as.
Or you could do a slash.
Yeah.
Or copper comeback.
Ooh, just see, look, this is what happens when you take the pressure off. He just comes up with them.
Doesn't make as much sense. That doesn't make as much sense. Who hasn't seen the film?
We're not about making sense here.
Just remember to look at your phone next time, your flash phone, and think about that phone after you've watched the film.
Yeah. Because Simon's absolutely right. The components in your phone would not, like, the phone would not be possible without components mined from places like Bougainville. Mm-hmm. It's the third world countries that are being destroyed.
Up.
Yeah, dug up in order to make
and then
the
buried in it
world.
Once we throw them out.
Indeed.
Think about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is our show for this week. Next week, well, at the very least, we're going to be talking about Naomi Watts as Princess Diana, the long-awaited biography of her. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, which is called Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software. iTunes is giving me so much grief at the moment. I tell you what, I'm almost, you know, I'm such a loyal Apple person, but I'm very close to changing my mind. Anyway, the latest episode should always be downloaded automatically. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store, because those ratings, those reviews, they help push us up. I did a search in iTunes actually on Mr. Pip, and we are number one.
Woohoo!
By the way, our last week's episode. So that's
fantastic.
Nice, isn't it?
It is. That's
yep.
great.
And you can contact us with your two-word reviews or longer. Don't feel too constrained just by our silliness.
No, you can find us on Twitter if you have two words or, you know, 140 characters, via @CinematicaCast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can read our 2, 3, 4, and 5-word reviews every week, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast. You can email us at CinematicaFullStopPodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. This is Stephen Price and the theme music, the closing theme to Gravity. I was actually wanting to play Tim Finn's song from the end of Mr. Pip, but you can't buy it. It's not on iTunes, and it doesn't appear to have been released as a record, which seems to me to be a little short-sighted on the part of everybody concerned. Because if you're going to sell the soundtrack song to a film, you'd think now would be the time.
Now is the time.
So, gosh darn it, not able to do that. So it is Stephen Price and Gravity. Until next week, that's all from me.
And me.
And me, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Happy holidays.
Thanks.
Fantastic. We need postcards.
Yep.
Yep, multiple.
Yep.